This is Phil Farron.
And I am driving home. Took me a moment there to get the key in the lock to start my car. It's been a good week. It's Thursday today. I don't think I'm coming in tomorrow, but it's been a good week. All is well. Had meetings most of this week, so I've spent the last 2 days sitting in a conference room, but that's okay. We were able to get accomplished a lot of good things and able to move forward to the next step on those things, so all is well there, and I think we're all kind of doing okay. We're just doing okay. Moving forward. Anyways, so let's see. It was Valentine's Day last Friday. We did do a Cupid outfit, kind of a steampunky Cupid outfit. I won't talk about that too much, simply because I did something different this time than I had done before. I'm trying to remember if I mentioned this last time. I don't know, so we'll just go over it quickly. I had noticed there's a definite difference between someone seeing a picture of me in costume and someone having a direct interaction with me in costume. And there's just no two ways about that. I usually have some kind of little information prepared along with the costume, and I'm dynamically editing that information based on the person. So I'm coming up with a little routine for that person specifically based on how long I perceive they want that interaction to go, based on what they happen to be doing at the moment, based on what I know of their personality. And so there's all this kind of dynamic back and forth that is happening with the costumes, and you just lose all of that when you just have a picture. So I decided I would break down and record some videos, and I'll just go ahead and post them on my little YouTube channel, and then I'll also upload them to Facebook. And it allows people to see and to watch and listen and, you know, kind of participate in more of an actual type experience. So that, I seem to have gotten a lot of good input from that, as much as I get on social media, because I do not have a million followers, thank God, because I don't need a million followers. And I have, I don't know, 500, 600, I haven't checked recently, 600 friends, something like that. And one of the videos had gotten like 400 views and that kind of stuff. So it's fine, you know, it's fine. It's people, it's getting done what it needs to get done. But from here on out, I'm probably going to do that if my daughter will help me out with that, which she's always very gracious to help out. And so we'll do three little videos. One will be the bit, so the stuff that I would normally talk about with that costume on, and then the making of, so just the little tidbits about how I made the decision to have that particular costume and I paired it with whatever. And then the third one would be just reactions. So those three videos are out there already, and you know, there's no there's no need to rehash that information if you're interested. Just, and you aren't my friend on Facebook, just send me a Facebook friend request. Phil Farron. I think it's just Phil Farron. P-H-I-L. And then F as in Frank. A-R-R-A-N-D as in dog. And, you know, I'll respond to your friend request. And you can just go to my feed and see the videos there. So that all went well. There was kind of one amusing interchange that didn't make it onto the videos because I forgot. Because I was, the Cupid outfit was black and red, and it was a fairly bold red and black, including the wings. You know, if you weren't kind of paying attention to potentials, you wouldn't necessarily immediately conclude that it was steampunk Cupid, which is fine. And so there was definitely a potential to be misunderstood there. And in fact, as I was doing a little bit of grocery shopping on Saturday, it has turned into a thing now where costume days are both Friday and Saturday, because I go to a different restaurant between Friday morning and Saturday morning. So sometimes I end up at Walmart twice, once on Friday, once on Saturday. So on Saturday, when I was in at Walmart picking up some groceries, because my wife had her best friend from college in and her mom staying the weekend with us, I happened to look up and see a mother and two children. The children were 8-ish, 10-ish, 11-ish, somewhere in there. And I smile and nodded, and I heard the mom say something to the effect of, see, that's not like, what did she call me? A demon or the devil or something? I don't know. That's not like a demon. He's a nice person. Like, okay, well, didn't really expect to have that interpretation, but, you know, it was a young girl, and apparently the costume frightened her a bit. So that stuff happens occasionally. You can't control people's reactions, and there's a wide variety of people who have a wide variety of reactions. All in all, though, I won't rehash the reaction video, but there were lots of smiles, lots of fun. I did have a friend, I may have mentioned this on the video, but it's fun. I did have a friend who wasn't going to be able to make it by on Friday to Walmart like she normally does, because she was babysitting her grandson. And she said, oh, she said, I'm going to miss it. But she put at the end of her little text that she had sent me, she said, make lots of smiles today. So, and I wrote her back. I said, I will do my best. Because that's really what this is, you know. And so we had a lot of fun in Walmart, walking through and talking to the workers there. And then, you know, I went up to my current major client and visited a bunch of offices up there. And we laughed and carried on, and it was fun. And went over to my dad's old doctor's office and laughed and carried on there. Went to a billing office, laughed and carried on there. Went to another friend who works at a chiropractic office, because she likes to see the office. And she told me later, she said that when I walked in, she was behind the counter talking with one of the other office people. And she said the other office person, when she heard me look up and say something about, hi, Phil, she said this person was saying under their breath, don't go out there. Don't go out there. Don't go out there. It might not be safe. And she said, no. She said, it's fine. I know him. He's fine. You know, so went there. That was fun. And then went to the retirement village where my mom and my dad stayed in the latter portions of their life, and went to talk to the office staff there. And a good time was had by all. So it was worth doing. It was fun. Lots of fun. And you know, so hung that costume up until next year, and then we'll do it again next year. I am going to do a little small thing for Friday tomorrow, because this is National Random Acts of Kindness Week. So there is a National Random Acts of Kindness Day, which is February the 17th, which would have been on Monday. But since 2018, there has been the declaration of a Random Acts of Kindness Week. So I got a little something-something that I threw together real quick for that. I think it'll be cute. It won't look like the devil. So it'll be fun. So that's all well. The writing is going well. I theoretically... I have a week and a half until I wrap this up, this book. I I'm close because I have two good solid days of writing, Friday and Saturday, to finish up this week. Unless something strange happens, I don't believe there'll be a problem getting that finished up. And then I have a solid week next week of writing, and I don't have any, you know, huge intrusions on my schedule at this point. So I think I'm pretty close. I might be a day or two over by the time I get the epilogue in and all that kind of stuff, but that's okay. That's okay. Then I start my read through in March. Take me a week and a half or so to do the read through, build the files out, get the beta copies ready, get the beta copies ordered. And then as soon as I get that done, I've got to turn around and get my taxes done. So that's, I usually wait until I get beta copy files all put together, and that puts me somewhere around the third week of March. And so I usually am doing my taxes, I don't know, 2 to 3 weeks ahead of time. So I'm not waiting until the last minute, as some people do, but certainly I'm not getting them done the first week of January because of the writing. So all is well there, all is well with the family, all is well. So life is good. It's just good. Let's see, this week I was looking around for something to talk about on the podcast, and I came across an article called "Physics is Pointing Inexorably to Mind." I thought, well, that's an interesting article. And just to give you a little context, this article did appear in Scientific America. It was in the opinion section, so there was a big disclaimer down at the bottom, you know, Scientific American, blah, 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 blah. Let's see, the views expressed by the authors are not necessarily those of Scientific American. There was a disclaimer down there for this, because this, the article leads to very, well, leads to potential conclusions that might not necessarily be welcomed by everyone, but it is what it is. And that is, there are some now physicists, famous physicists, and we may have talked about some of this already, and this is just a follow-on article. I did see if I had talked about this specific article, and I hadn't, but now that I look at it, Max Tegmark sounds familiar, and I probably have touched on this topic before, but that's okay, because we're here, and I have the article in front of me. Max Tegmark, in 2014, in his book Our Mathematical Universe, he's a physicist, he boldly claims that, quote, protons, atoms, molecules, cells, and stars are all redundant, quote, baggage, unquote. All the mathematical apparatus used to describe the behavior of matter is supposedly real, but not matter itself. For Tegmark, the universe is a, quote, set of abstract entities with relationships between them, unquote, which, quote, can be described in a baggage-independent way, and unquote. And by that, he means without matter. So he's saying that you can describe the universe simply as a set of equations, and that universe exists without the need for matter. The article goes on to say he attributes existence solely to descriptions, while incongruously denying the very thing that is described in the first place. Matter is done away with, and only information is to be taken as ultimately real. So there you go. This abstract notion called information realism is philosophical in character, but it has been associated with physics from its very inception. Most famously, information realism is a popular philosophical underpinning for digital physics. I don't really know what digital physics is, but it's something. The motivation for this association is not hard to fathom. The article says, indeed, according to Greek atomists, if we kept dividing things into ever smaller bits, at the end there would remain solid, indivisible particles called atoms, imagined to be so concrete as to even have peculiar shapes. Yet, as our understanding of physics has progressed, we've realized that the atoms themselves can be further divided into smaller bits, and those into yet smaller bits, and so on, until what is left lacks shape and solidarity altogether. At the bottom of the chain of physical reduction, there are only elusive, phantasmal entities we label as energy and fields. Abstract conceptual tools for describing nature, which themselves seem to lack any real and concrete essence. So this gets to the whole quantum realm stuff. I'm not on the article anymore. This is me. So we divided down, we got to the place where we said, okay, well, great. So there must be atoms, there must be protons, electrons, all that kind of stuff. And then we decided that there were quarks. And then we decided that maybe there were vibrating strings of energy. Skunk. Wow. At least I didn't hit the skunk this time. A couple of days ago, I did hit the skunk. And it must have splashed some of its scent or something on the bottom of the car, because I smelled that every time I went out of the garage for several days. Anyways, so you get below quarks, and then you get into vibrating strings, and then you get into this quantum foam, quantum field stuff where everything just seems to be chaotic, doesn't make any sense at all. And the only way you can really describe it in any sort of efficient way is with quantum mechanics. It's all these strange equations that don't predict necessarily specific things, but just probabilities. So, everything becomes ephemeral. The article goes on to say, to some physicists, this indicates that what we call matter, with its solidarity and concreteness, is an illusion. That only the mathematical apparatus they devise in their theories is truly real, not the perceived world the apparatus was created to describe in the first place. From their viewpoint, such a counterintuitive conclusion is an implication of theory, not a conspicuously narcissistic and self-defeating proposition. Indeed, according to informational realists, matter arises from information processing, not the other way around. Even mind, psyche, soul is supposedly a derivative phenomenon of purely abstract information manipulation. But in such a case, what exactly is meant by the word information, since there is no mental or physical substrate to ground it? The author of the article goes on to say, you see, it is one thing to state in language that information is primary and can exist, But it is another thing entirely to explicitly and coherently conceive of what, if anything, this may mean. By way of analogy, it is possible to write, as Lewis Carroll did, that the Cheshire cat's grin remains after the cat disappears, but it is another thing entirely to conceive explicitly and coherently of what this means. One moment, getting my mail. So this is a pretty interesting idea, and it's interesting that as physics has wound its way down, again, getting back to that idea of the three waves of science, that the first wave is observation, the second wave is an apprehension of some of the complexities involved, and an apprehension of what that might mean, and that there is a third wave then that comes through, and we finally get to the place where everything just seems so very, very complex that the only conclusion that we can come to is that there is some God, some creator behind it, where because we were apprehensive about the complexity in the second wave, we decided there wasn't. So this kind of fits in all of that. So the article goes on to say that information exists in and of itself is akin to speaking of a spin without a top, of ripples without waters, of a dance without a dancer, or of the Cheshire's grin without the cat. It is a grammatically valid sentence devoid of sense, a word game less meaningful than fantasy, for internally consistent fantasy can at least be explicitly and coherently conceived of such. One assumes that serious proponents of information realism are well aware of this line of criticism. How then do they reconcile their position with it? A passage by Luciano Floridi may provide a clue. In a section titled The Nature of Information, he states, "Information, quote, information is notoriously a polymorphic phenomenon and a polysemantic concept, so as an explicandum, it can be associated with several explanations depending on the level of abstraction adopted and the cluster of requirements and desiderata orientating a theory. Information remains an elusive concept." In other words, we have no idea what we just mean by information, even though we're saying that's what's at the bottom of all this. It's information. The author of the article continues, "The untenability of information realism, however, does not erase the problem that motivated it to begin with, the realization that at the bottom, what we call matter becomes pure abstraction, a phantasm. How can the felt concreteness and solidity of the perceived world evaporate out of existence when we look closely at matter? To make sense of this conundrum, we don't need the word games of informational realism. Instead, we must stick to what is most immediately present to us, the solidity and concreteness that qualifies our existence. The world measured, modeled, and ultimately predicted by physics is a world of perceptions, a category of mentation. The phantasms and abstractions relied merely in our descriptions of the behavioral world, not in the world itself." So he goes on to say that Tegman is correct in considering matter to be unnecessary baggage, but the implication of this fine and indeed brave conclusion is that the universe is a mental construct displayed on the screen of perception. Tegmark's mathematical universe is inherently a mental one, for where does mathematics, numbers, sets, equation exist if not in mentation? The author says, as I elaborate extensively in my new book, The Idea of the World, The mental universe exists in mind, but not in your personal mind alone. Instead, it is a transpersonal field of mentation that presents itself to us as physicality with its concrete solidity and definiteness once our personal mental processes interact with it through observation. This mental universe is what physics is leading us to, not the hand-waving word games of informational realism. How interesting is that? Now, I don't know how accepted this idea is in physics, or if this is a brand new thing, or it was printed in the Scientific American. But I find it very interesting that the conclusion that we begin to come to, if we're honest, is that science, i.e. quantum theory, seems to be telling us that in fact everything we perceive as matter is really just information processing. But of course, when we come to those conclusions, we have to take a step back and say, what is processing the information in the first place? And it's not just me, but there has to be some mentality that is processing the information, that potentially is bringing coherence to the information, that causes our world, solid as it may seem and organized as it may seem, to arise out of the foam, the quantum foam, and achieve coherence. And even more fascinating is the fact that, as we've talked about multiple times, Paul, 2,000 years ago, in writing Colossians, throws in a very interesting phrase when he is referring to Christ as agent of creation. And let me just look it up real quick, because I'd like to quote that correctly. I mean, I can give you my approximation of it easily. But let me just look it up real quickly. It's Colossians chapter 1. And in describing who Jesus Christ is and his preeminence, starting with verse 15, Paul says in the English Standard Version, "He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, for by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him, and he is before all things, and in him all things hold together." And as I understand the Greek involved, that's actually active when he says, "in him all things hold together." I'm just going to jump over to the Amplified Version. It says in the Amplified Version, verse 16, "For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, things visible and invisible, whether thrones and dominions or rulers and authority. All things were created and exist through him, that is, by his activity and for him. And he himself existed and is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is the controlling, cohesive force of the universe." He is the cohesive force of the universe. He is active, present, holding all things together. From this perspective, then, we can make the claim and we can hold in our minds the idea that we are a manifestation of his mind, that it is by his will he has created this marvelous, beautiful environment has given this us this wondrous gift of free will, has given us the wondrous gift of knowing Him and experiencing Him. He holds all things together, moment by moment, and He guides us and He helps us in our lives. We may experience heartache. We may experience suffering. We may bring some of that on ourselves by our own decisions. But as I was telling a friend this last week, the marvelous thing about life is that no matter how many decisions you made to get to a bad place in your life, you can, at any point, start making better decisions. And once you start making better decisions, you can see your life turn for the better. And there's always a way back to life and away from destruction. That's really cool. That's not to say that you aren't going to inherit certain consequences from the decisions that you make, but there's always a way back to life. And that's because even though He has given us free will and He has given us the ability to really mess up our lives, He is still there at every moment, holding us together, whispering to us, trying to lead us towards life. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.